Good day. Today is Wednesday, 28th January 2026. And before I proceed with this program, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this program or whichever part of this program you want to watch, you decide that you've liked what you've heard and wished to indicate that fact. Now, over the last 24 hours, there's been a lot of talk relating to the situation in Ukraine about the mysterious appearance of Russian reconnaissance drones flying over Kiev and apparently other places. These drones have been identified as of a type called BM-35s. They resemble but are not part of the Garand family of drones. They're different, and they include various surveillance cameras and those sort of things. And interestingly, there are reports originating from Ukraine complaining that these drones operate and are guided by the Russians using signals drawn from the Starlink system. I'm not going to discuss the technology because, straightforwardly, I'm not the right person to do that. Now, that's already led to complaints from some people in Ukraine and some people outside Ukraine. Radek Sikorsky, for example, being one of them, that the Starlink system, which is an American system, is being used by the Russians to track to send drones that carry out these surveillance operations inside Ukraine. And there are also stories that the Russians use other types of drones and that these also operate using signals from the Starlink system. Sikorsky has demanded to know why Starlink and Elon Musk permit this. There's been a rather tense exchange of messages between Sikorsky and Musk. Musk has responded by saying that Starlink, the entire Ukrainian military, depends for its communications on the Starlink system, which to me implies that if Musk were to do what Sikorsky demands, he would not just have to switch off Starlink to prevent the Russians operating drones over Ukraine. The shutoff would interfere or would perhaps end Ukraine's own military communications as well. Well, I'm not going to get into the details of this, the technology of this, which, as I said, isn't really my field at all. But perhaps a bigger question is this new? Is it new that there are Russian drones carrying out surveillance suddenly on this sort of scale? And if so, why is it happening at this point in the war? Well, first of all, I am sure that the Russians regularly conduct surveillance over Ukraine, and I've no doubt that they have often used drones to do it. And I wonder whether this is indeed happening on any much bigger scale than previously. It may be simply that one of the reasons why there are many more Russian drones operating over Ukraine now is because the air defences in Ukraine are close to collapse, and that makes it easier for the Russians to conduct observations using drones. I would say that since the start of the special military operation, the Russians' ability to track and monitor what is taking place in Ukraine has increased exponentially. At the start of the special military operation, there is no doubt that the Ukrainians had a major advantage here. The United States operates a far more extensive satellite surveillance system than Russia does. It had satellites operating over the Ukrainian battlefields. It could provide Ukraine real-time information that was much more detailed and provide it much faster than the information from their satellites, which the Russians were receiving. And of course, the Americans had all sorts of other technologies and mechanisms to keep track of what the Russians were doing in Ukraine. Probably the Americans still have overall the advantage here, but the Russians have launched multiple satellites which have enabled them to keep track of military developments in Ukraine. Perhaps they don't have as deep and complex a surveillance system as the Americans do, but the gap has narrowed significantly, at least in terms of Ukraine. And anyway, the Russians not only receive information, intelligence and surveillance information, in far greater quantity than they used to do, but they are able to process this information and distribute it to the military units on the front lines far more rapidly. And it's probably the case that the Russians have been operating drones over Ukraine in the past, but my guess is that they are operating many more drones now. And of course, drones are not just a supplement to the satellites, but they perform different tasks from the satellites. They can operate much closer to the ground. They are probably more adaptable to close range surveillance than satellites are. Again, I'm not an expert in these matters, so I'm not going to discuss the extent of what is going on. But probably there has been a significant jump in drone surveillance capability, strategic drone surveillance capability on the Russian side as well. I suspect that over the last few weeks, maybe the last week or so, Russian drones have been much more visible in the skies over Kiev and other places, precisely because there are indeed many more of them there. And I'm a little surprised that no one is asking what for me is the obvious question, which is that if the Russians are indeed conducting very detailed surveillance now using drones of Kiev and apparently of other places in Ukraine, isn't that a further sign that they're gathering information of a sort that they didn't have at the start, at the very beginning of the special military operation in February 2022, and that they're doing this at a far greater and much more granular level? And isn't that perhaps a sign that a big Russian offensive, as I have speculated in recent programs, might be coming? We know that the Russians have the manpower to do it. They have reserve armies, two reserve armies, apparently close to the Ukrainian border, and further reserves in the rear. The Russian military has been built up and massively expanded since February 2022. The officers and the non-commissioned officers have now experience of war. The logistics have been massively reorganized. And of course, there's a constant drumbeat of speculation as to why the Russians haven't acted more aggressively in the war up to now, why they have acted incrementally. Maybe one of the reasons they've been acting incrementally is because they've been building up their reserves in the rear in preparation for the big attack, the big offensive that might come. Just saying. And if this was being done by another country, if it was being done by the United States, if, for example, we saw attacks on the energy system of a targeted country, blackouts across cities. Apparently, the start of interference in internet activity. And if we saw American drones hovering over the cities of the targeted country, we would all be speculating that some big American strike, some big American operation, military operation, was in the works. And why do we not do so with the Russians? Just saying. It would be perhaps unsurprising. It would arguably be logical. It could be that with the Russians perhaps expecting the cities, the fortified cities in Donbass, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, to fall before long, that they are planning some big offensive that will take place after that, that they're gathering intelligence in preparation for that offensive, that they're working out their data. They have the people on the ground, they have the men on the ground, they have the machines ready, and that the strike might come. Everything that we have seen play out over the winter seems to me to support that hypothesis. The attacks on the energy system, the attacks on the communication system, the railways, and those sort of things. Perhaps I'm wrong. As I've said many times, the Russian General Staff and the Russian Defense Ministry do not share their information, their plans with me. They have recently been providing some hints about their plans, but these have been, if you like, of a short-term tactical operational basis rather than the kind of long-term planning that an offensive might imply. Again, let me stress, I don't know, but I can speculate and I can guess, and it somewhat surprises me. It puzzles me a little that people in the West are not asking themselves the same questions. Perhaps in the defense ministries and in the intelligence communities in the West, they are. But judging on from some of the things that I've been reading in the Western media, which may indeed reflect the continuing consensus within the intelligence communities in the West, the Russians are unable to conduct big offensives because their military is all but exhausted. The level of losses has been astronomically high. They lose about 3 or 4 or 7 or 10 men for every man that the Ukrainian army loses. It's impossible for the Russians to sustain the war, to keep the war going for very much longer. And that does appear to be the consensus of many people in the West, especially in Europe. We had that article by Seymour Hersh, which appeared about a week ago, which spoke of bafflement and frustration on the part of the US intelligence community that the Russians continue the war, that Vladimir Putin continues the war, despite the enormous losses and the economic damage that Russia is suffering, and that there is puzzlement and incomprehension about this. And as I've discussed in previous programs, it seemed to me that this article floated the possibility that the way to resolve this problem was to deal with the person who is to blame for the fact that the Russians don't seem to understand that they're suffering these enormous losses and that their economy is cracking. And that person, obviously, is Vladimir Putin. And the right approach, therefore, is to get rid of him. And everything at that point will come right. So you have that. There's also been an article in the Financial Times by Gideon Rackman, who also speaks about the enormous Russian losses, the exhaustion of the Russian military, the fact that the situation is in stalemate, the fact that the negotiations that began in Abu Dhabi last week might take years, and again the puzzlement that in spite of all these losses, in spite of all this exhaustion, the Kremlin sticks to what Gideon Rachman referred to as its maximalist demands. The one possibility which never seems to occur to these people, which might actually be the answer to the riddle that they are setting themselves as to why the Russians continue to take a tough line, why they're showing no interest in compromise at all. The one answer to that riddle, which is that perhaps the Russian losses are nowhere near as great as they believe, that the Russian economy is not in crisis and not exhausted, that inflation is falling, that budget is under control, that the financial situation is stable, that in fact the entire premise that they have constructed of Russian exhaustion and Ukrainian resilience is simply wrong, and that the Kremlin does not feel under the kind of pressure to compromise that they imagine. Well, that of course is something that apparently they simply refuse to consider. And well, we have been here before. Now, I can understand why someone like Gideon Rachman, who presumably gets his information mostly from British sources, who in turn get their information from Ukrainian sources, I can understand why Gideon Rachman might be accepting these claims that the Russians are suffering these horrendous casualties and that their economy is under extreme stress. I can understand why someone like him, given the views he's known to have and the people he's likely to be speaking to and his background, why he might believe this. I'm a little puzzled as to why Seymour Hersh, of all people, should be swept along by these stories. After all, he was a reporter during the Vietnam War. He ought to remember how then, during the Vietnam War, the United States military, as is now universally acknowledged, systematically overreported North Vietnamese losses, giving a profoundly distorted understanding back in Washington of the direction the war is taking. A person who was there in Washington analysing the data and trying to push back on all of these stories about enormous North Vietnamese losses, and who is still one of the most insightful commentators today, was Ray McGovern, who, of course, at that time was one of the people of the CIA who was trying to push back against all of these claims. I remember something very similar happening in the 1980s during the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. Again, all sorts of figures were circulating around about hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of Soviet soldiers being killed in Afghanistan. And when the Soviet army pulled out and provided their actual casualty figures, which have been independently corroborated ever since many times, we discovered that the true number was orders of magnitude less. So yes, we do have more sources of data today, but over-reliance on technology can sometimes be deceiving, and given the record, given the past record of systematic, massive overreporting of the enemy's losses by intelligence agencies in the West, including American intelligence agencies. I find it very, very strange that reporters in the West, people who were there, like Seymour Hersh, don't consider the possibility that the same is happening again. And one could see where some of these sources of overreporting might come from. A few weeks ago, Jeff Roberts, the British historian, pointed out to me that an article in The Guardian about Ukrainian drone units showed that Ukrainian drone operators get rewarded for every Russian soldier they kill. And almost inevitably, that is going to result in over-reporting. When something like that happens, when you reward operators in that sort of way, even if you try to create fail-safes, over-reporting is almost baked in. And, well, just 2 days ago, I read an article in the Daily Telegraph that said the same thing. It also said that Ukrainian drone operators get rewarded by the number of Russian kills that they in turn report. And given that the Ukrainians, and indeed the Russians, say that personnel losses today are mostly accounted for by drones, well, you could see how over-reporting of losses, of Russian losses, by Ukrainian drone operators, and we could see that there is an incentive, a baked-in incentive for that to happen. We could see how that could and almost certainly does happen. And, well, we could see the enormous possibilities for distortion that this must be creating. And again, it surprises me how very few people in the West can see that. It also surprises me, given that we do have information from one agency, Mediazona, who claim to be tracking actual Russian fatalities based on open source information within Russia. They have, by the way, taken steps to provide some reassurance about the accuracy of the data they are providing. They're now providing the names of the Russian soldiers whose they say have been killed. They're providing information, more detailed information than they have been doing up to now. And as I said, that does restore some of my faith in their credibility. Anyway, they are putting the number of Russian fatalities, actual recorded Russian fatalities, not estimated Russian fatalities, which is a completely different thing, and which, in my opinion, is something that one should disregard. Anyway, they're putting actual recorded Russian fatalities over the 4 years of the war at 160,000, which is an awful lot, but very, very far less than the inflated numbers that we are seeing circulating in the West. And 160,000 Russian casualties, Russian fatalities, by the standards of Russian wars, is not so high, just to say. Maybe a lot in the West. In Russia, given the recent history there, it would not seem so high, especially given that it is over a four-year period. And it is certainly a level of loss that the Russian military would be able to absorb, just saying. So, there it is. We may be making calculations, assessments, on the basis of wrong data. Now, here, when I discussed the possibilities of a big Russian offensive coming, I ought to just reveal the conversation I once had with Ray McGovern. I think it might actually have been in a live stream, in which he pointed out that one of the reasons that the United States in 1968 had no expectations that the North Vietnamese were about to launch their great Tet offensive, and why the Tet offensive, when it happened, came as a total surprise. One of the reasons why the Americans weren't expecting it was precisely because they were getting wrong, inflated information, grossly inflated information about North Vietnamese casualties. They assumed that the North Vietnamese did not have the resources to carry out an offensive, which of course they did. Now, having said all of that, I'm not suggesting that a Russian offensive, a big Russian offensive, if it is coming, is going to happen over the next few days or weeks. If such a thing were indeed about to happen, then presumably we would start to see big troop movements either close to or across the border, and we haven't yet seen that happen. But bear in mind that the Russians are probably working very hard to sort out the logistics in the conflict zone. They're bringing the railway lines and the roads back into a state of repair. They are undoubtedly doing that, if only to facilitate ongoing military operations. But if they are doing that, if they are forward moving their stockpiles of ammunition and explosives and fuel and all of that sort of thing, which probably they are, then it might not take very long for these large bodies of troops to be moved into position. Again, this is an area which is not within my field of expertise. But given everything that has happened in the war, and given the extent to which the Russians take the issue of logistics extremely seriously and like to prepare for big logistical operations in advance, if something like that is happening, then it wouldn't surprise me. Well, anyway, I've set out why I think a big offensive from the Russian side is possible, why it certainly cannot be ruled out. I think in the West, perhaps in Ukraine as well, they have a false idea about Russian losses. I think in the West, they underestimate the resources that the Russians can bring into play. And, well, we see the development of the situation on the front lines, perhaps consistent with the early preparations for such an offensive. And we see the Russians taking steps to knock out the energy system across Ukraine, prepare perhaps for the shutdown of the internet across Ukraine. They've already clearly developed a great deal of information about how to suppress Starlink. We saw that from the jamming of the Starlink terminals in Iran. And bear in mind, it might at the moment be useful for the Russians to allow Starlink to continue to operate in Iran, in Ukraine, if they're listening in and are able to glean information from the information that the Ukrainians themselves are passing through Starlink. Anyway, it could be that all of that is going on. And of course, it's not just the energy system that the Russians have been attacking, but warehouses, stockpiles, command centres in various places, repair facilities. The Oreshnik strike in Lvov appears to have been connected in some way to that. And of course, also the railway system, which is now under systematic attack in a way that was not possible for the Russians earlier in the war. So I'm not making predictions. I'm just throwing out possibilities. There are possibilities which, as I said, it does seem to me surprising that nobody is considering up to this time. Well, in the meantime, what is going on the front lines? The Russians continue to conduct their drone attacks. At the moment, they are only conducting drone attacks. We had the last big missile strike on Kiev, which took place a few days ago, using the various advanced missiles, the Tsarkons, the Iskanders, the Kinjals. And we also have had drone attacks on other places, on Odessa, the port of which is now, in effect, under aerial blockade. And the Russians continue to hammer Kharkiv, Chernigov, Sumy, all of these places. I understand that in terms of energy, heating and that kind of thing, the situation in Kharkiv continues to be extremely bad. And bear in mind what I said also in a recent program. If the Russians really do have a plan to try to get the Ukrainians, to get people out of the cities, to evacuate the cities, or if the Russians are trying to push civilians to leave the cities, which is a terrible thing, by the way, but if that is what the Russians are doing, that also would be consistent with preparations for an offensive which might target specifically those cities and target them for storming as well. Anyway, the drone attacks continue. The missile attacks, the missile strikes will almost certainly before long resume again. And in the meantime, there continues to be movement on the front lines. This morning, Igor Kimakovsky, who is one of Denis Pushilin's aides, Denis Pushilin is the head of the Russian-backed regional government of Donetsk. Anyway, Kimakovsky discussed the situation in Kupiansk. He seemed to take it for granted that Gerasimov's claim made yesterday and repeated by the Russian Defense Ministry, that the Russians have captured the strategically important village of Kupiansk-Uzlovoy, located south of the city of Kupiansk, is true. There are still many people who heatedly deny this, including people on the Russian side. But anyway, Kimakovsky seemed to assume or seemed to know that this is true. And given that he works for the Donetsk regional government, you would suspect that he would know, that he would be fairly well briefed about the actual true situation on the front lines. Anyway, he speculated about the opportunities for the Russian military that this would provide. He spoke about the very difficult situation for the Ukrainians in the Kupiansk area and about the enormous losses they are suffering. I suspect, by the way, that the Russians also overstate Ukrainian losses, though not, without, definitely not to the same degree as the West, and the Ukrainians overstate Russian losses, but I'm not going to discuss all that now. Anyway, that's one thing that one could say. Yesterday, Redovka, Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, very much, as I've said, on the nationalist side of the Russian political spectrum, strongly supportive of the Russian operations in Ukraine, but in my opinion also very close to the military and probably briefed by the Russian military about events. Anyway, Radovka spoke about a Russian breakthrough in Liman, that the Russian forces in Liman are now moving rapidly inside the town. It said that in most of Liman, Ukrainian defence is rather ragged, but that the Ukrainians are putting up a tough resistance. In southeast Liman, where they're able to take advantage of the presence of large buildings, concrete and stone buildings like the city administration building and those sort of places, which they can use as strong points to try to hold the Russians back. But Radovka said that because of the general shortage of Ukrainian troops in Liman, it might be difficult for the Ukrainians to hold on to these positions as well. And if the rest of Liman were to fall, the risk the Ukrainian troops holding out in these buildings would face is that they would become surrounded and isolated, which, by the way, according to the Russians, is what happened to some of the Ukrainian troops that continue to hold out in the town of Stepnogorsk in Zaporozhye region. They held out in a specific fortified area after the rest of the town had fallen and as a result became surrounded. Now, again, I'm not there. I don't know what the actual situation in Liman is. The Ukrainians are not providing a huge amount of information about it. But if Liman does fall, given that Siversk has already fallen, it will leave the Ukrainians in a very difficult position in the northern parts, in the northern area of the Donbass fortified line, in Slavyansk, in the area of Slavyansk. The Russians are pushing towards Slavyansk from other directions as well. They're gradually advancing west of Siversk towards Slavyansk too. And apparently Liman, relative to Slavyansk, is on high ground. And again, if the Russians are able to take Liman, that will put them in a position of advantage. There is also heavy fighting going on in Konstantinovka. And north of Pokrovsk, there's information partly provided by Gerasimov that the Russians are advancing closer to the town of Dobropilia, which is located directly north of Pokrovsk. It's the last remaining important defense position that the Ukrainians have in northwest in Donetsk region. According to Gerasimov, the Russians are in the process of storming the town of Belitska, which is located north of Rodinska, and the Russians are also in the process of storming the village of Novodonbass, which is also located in this general area and which would also bring the Russians closer to Dobropilia as well. So the capture of Dobropilia not only would enable the Russians to bring northwest Donetsk under control, but it would facilitate this encirclement of the fortified cities of Kramatorsk and Slavyansk, and it would also facilitate the Russian operations in Konstantinovka, where the fighting remains apparently very intense and where the Russians do appear to be pushing forward. And in Zaporozhye region, well, there's less information at the moment, but the Russian pincers on Orekhov continue to tighten. And I read an article from a Ukrainian source which spoke about a deteriorating situation south of Zaporozhye city and worried that before long the Russians would be able to bring the city of Zaporozhye itself within range of their artillery, their medium range artillery, and that would be a very, very bad thing for the Ukrainians indeed. Well, there it is. Now, I spent some time discussing the military situation and the possibilities of a Russian offensive. We've had, of course, that meeting in Abu Dhabi, the tripartite meeting, the Ukrainians, the Russians, and the Americans present. The Ukrainians are now very upset by the reports from the United States, the indications of the United States, that the United States is not prepared to give Ukraine a security guarantee until there is a final peace settlement. And that, obviously, for that to happen, Ukraine must make the first step, which is to withdraw from Donbass, which is something that the Ukrainian leadership categorically refuses to do. So the Ukrainians are very upset about that. The Ukrainian foreign minister, Mr. Shmigal, has actually suggested that there will not be a single peace agreement. He's suggested a very strange arrangement whereby the United States and Russia reach an agreement with each other about the situation in Ukraine, and that the Ukrainians in turn come to their own separate agreement with the United States. In other words, there should not be a single global draft, a single global treaty or document which both the Russians and the Ukrainians sign. There is absolutely no possibility that the Russians will agree to that. And if the Ukrainians think that, then it is a fantasy. But one can understand why the Ukrainians might be doing that. They're probably at the moment seeking security guarantees of the United States. That is more their priority. They are never going to agree, at least this Ukrainian political leadership is not going to agree formally to any cession of territory, be it de jure or de facto, to the Russians. The Americans might do that, but the Ukrainians won't, and the Ukrainians are not going to be bound by whatever the Americans agree. So this is a totally unrealistic, fantastic position, as far as I'm concerned. And, well, the Ukrainians, nonetheless, cling to it because they don't want to do the deal with the Russians, the Istanbul Plus deal, which the Russians are insisting on. And to my mind, that makes a negotiated outcome of this conflict all but impossible. In which case, it will end in military terms on the battlefields. And at that point, speculating about the possibility of a Russian offensive this year, a big Russian knockout offensive this year, and looking at what the Russians are doing in possible preparation for that, seems to me to be a fully meaningful exercise. Given the Ukrainian stance, I would have thought it was even more important for people in the West to at least consider that possibility and look at the situation both on the front lines and what is going on behind them on the Russian side as well. Anyway, what else is going on? Well, the Europeans continue to be in a congratulatory mood about their decision to stop importing gas from Russia, a legal decision that they're all going to be bound by. I discussed it at length yesterday. In the meantime, I received some information about the actual movements of energy around the world. And of course, this ties in rather closely with information that we have, in fact, some public information, the fact that the European Union has just completed a free trade agreement with India. And it's been pointed out to me that Russian-Indian relations, economic relations, and defence relations are becoming extremely close. The Russians and the Indians have been discussing aviation, cooperation in the aviation sector. There is a big air show underway in Hyderabad in India at the present time. The Russian officials there have said that discussions between them and India, the Indian defence and aerospace people, about setting up production lines for the Sukhoi 57 fifth generation fighter in India are now at a very advanced stage. This was said by, as I said, one of the officials. This is specific, there's an interview about this which you can read on the Russian TASS news agency. The Indians are also busy apparently looking to agree co-production agreements with the Russians for civilian airliners. The Ilyushin 114, which is a turboprop passenger aircraft, and the Sukhoi Superjet, which is now called in Russia, by the way, confusingly, the Yakovlev Superjet. That is apparently, those are the two aircraft that India is most interested in. From a Russian point of view, this makes very considerable sense. The Russians want to develop their own aerospace industry, but the Russian market, though large, is probably not big enough to absorb all of the various Russian aircraft, types of aircraft, that the Russians might want to build in the future. And so locking this in with India, getting the Indians to co-produce aircraft with Russia, provides an enormous market in India for these aircraft and makes the development of these aircraft economically more profitable and worthwhile, just saying. But the interesting thing about all of this is that the European Union, having just concluded a free trade agreement with India, it seems that increasingly there are European companies that also want to be involved and take advantage of this free trade agreement. And some of them apparently want to do this because they are interested in the kind of technological agreements that the Indians and the Russians are concluding with each other, and they want to tap into them. One of the things that apparently they are especially interested in, and you can find some information about this apparently from open sources, is that they want to understand what the Russians are doing in the field of advanced lithography. Russia historically was very strong in this area during the time of the Soviet Union. And there are growing reports that the Russians have managed to produce, using more simple techniques, advanced chips, up to the level of 10 nanometers. In fact, I know this to be a case. I've heard about this for some time, actually. And the Europeans want to know more about how the Russians might have done it. And they also want to know what the Russians might be doing to build and develop on that. And apparently a few European companies are interested in all of this. And the other thing, of course, is energy. Quietly, despite all of the denials, Russian oil continues to reach Europe. The Indians are now saying that they have reduced imports of oil from Russia from 1.8 million barrels a day to 1.3. This is actually well within the kind of thing you would expect to happen in market conditions, by the way. And I suspect that before long, we are going to see imports of Russian oil from India begin to take off again. And, of course, it will be packaged as oil from India rather than Russia. Given that the European Union has now concluded a free trade agreement with India, I don't myself see how it can go behind that now, reverse that now, and impose tariffs or sanctions on India that would contradict the terms of that free trade agreement. So anyway, all of that is underway. All of those discussions are underway. I would not be at all surprised if India becomes the transit point of trade carried out between Russia and Europe, trade conducted under the radar in oil, in various types of technology, in other industrial goods. The Americans won't be happy, but realistically, what can they do? And that brings me to the other thing that the Europeans are doing, because there's now been a troop of European leaders flying to China. Macron was there. Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, is there. He's going to be followed fairly soon by Friedrich Merz. In London, there is enormous opposition and criticism of Starmer, whose political position in Britain gets ever more wobbly, by the way. Anyway, there is a lot of criticism of Starmer for going to China. But as he has himself pointed out, in economic terms, there is no choice. China is now far too important in global trade terms to be ignored. So the Europeans have to go. Even as the Russian and Chinese energy ministers meet, which they are apparently in the process of doing, to discuss further energy cooperation between their countries. In other words, more Russian gas and oil heading towards China. China has now stopped importing Venezuelan oil. There's apparently been a decision, a formal decision made to that effect by the Chinese government in terms of importing heavy crude oil, which is needed for some applications. The obvious place to go is Russia. I suspect that Russia will take Venezuela's place in the Chinese oil import markets. So all of these things continue to take place. The economic siege on Russia that the United States and the Europeans engaged in February 2022, despite these eccentric decisions, like the decision to stop all gas imports from Russia, which I discussed in my program yesterday, that economic siege is gradually, we saw gradually, is rapidly breaking down. The Europeans are again issuing more warnings that they will intercept, they give themselves the right to intercept ships, which change their flags all the time and which are not properly insured. But the Russians are telling ships that trade with their country to register properly in Russia, to take out proper insurance, both with Russian, and by the way, there are other insurance as well. So the Russians will be able to cover all of that and provide naval escorts, as they have now increasingly done. So the Europeans continue to talk about pressure on the Russians. They talk to themselves about economic pressure and blockades on Russia. But increasingly, as we will see, the markets, the global markets, and the Russians themselves will adapt. They will adapt. They will sell to India. They will sell to China. And they will sell to Europe increasingly via India and China. And that is the reality of global trade. It has always been so, and it will continue to be so. And especially with a country as big and as economically developed and as critical to global supply chains and as Russia is, it cannot be otherwise. So anyway, there we go. That, for the moment, is the state of the war. The Russians are giving no indications over the last 24 hours that they're taking the diplomacy especially seriously. The meeting in Abu Dhabi took place, but they expect this to be a long, protracted affair. And if it is indeed the case, as I think possible, perhaps even likely, that they are planning something big in Ukraine this year, well, that will be the focus of their planning, not the diplomacy in Abu Dhabi, which has come far too late. Now, other things, of course, are taking place in the world. There is a huge naval armada from the United States piling up around Iran. As is always the case, Donald Trump gives contradictory information. He says that he wants to negotiate with the Ukrainians. He says that the Iranians want to do a deal, which is his way of telling them to make a deal. It is his way of telling them to capitulate to his demands, one of which is that they give up completely all rights to nuclear enrichment whatsoever and do away with their entire ballistic missile capability. I cannot imagine that the Iranians will agree to either of those things. There are rumours that Iranian and American diplomats are meeting secretly in some third country. A reasonable guess would be Oman. But the Iranians, for the moment at least, appear to assume that an American attack on them is coming. Pezeshkian, the Iranian president, called MBS, the crown prince and prime minister and de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, asking for the Saudis to try to dissuade the Americans from what it looks as if they're preparing to do. Pezeshkian and other Iranian officials are now fairly openly saying that if there is an attack on their country, and if this escalates into an all-out war, then they will not hesitate to close the Gulf of Hormuz, which they do have the capability to do. They acknowledge that this will cause economic damage to other countries, Saudi Arabia, of course, being one. But as they put it, what choice in this kind of situation would they have? MBS is apparently taking all these warnings seriously, and the reports suggest that he is indeed trying to persuade the Americans to slow down, to return to negotiations, to the track of negotiations, and to put aside ideas of attacking Iran. The Iranians have also, by the way, been making further threats. They have said that the USS Abraham Lincoln, which is the American supercarrier that is positioned close to Iran, is a target for the Iranians. I am not sure that the Iranians have the capability to strike at a USS, at a US Navy carrier. As I understand it, the problem is not the range of the missiles, the Iranian missiles, or even their capabilities. It is that a carrier is a continuously moving target, a fast-moving target. It moves at a speed, apparently, when it is in battle, of something like 30 knots. And, of course, it is surrounded by a protective wall of warships that are there to protect it. So it is a difficult target to track and to hit. But then I, of course, know absolutely nothing about the extent of Iranian capabilities in this area or of what assistance the Iranians might be getting from their friends. All I would say about this is that if a supercarrier is struck by an Iranian missile, then even if the carrier itself survives the strike, the effect is simply going to be tremendous. I don't want to even contemplate the possibility of what that might mean. But anyway, the Iranians are warning that they might do that. And the Iranians are also taking steps to protect themselves, as they failed to do in advance of the June 2025 12-day war against a decapitation strike. They're saying that any attempt to kill Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, would be taken by Iran as an act of all-out war. They've received verbal support for this from their regional allies, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the separate, completely distinct Hezbollah in Iraq. I understand that the Shia religious leadership in Iraq has also weighed in on Iran's side in this matter, though I haven't myself seen the reports about this. And perhaps more importantly, the Iranian government is apparently creating decentralized structure of authority in Iran. The regional governors have apparently been called into a meeting, had a meeting with the Iranian president, Pezeshkian. They were given, apparently, emergency powers so that if Iranian officials in Tehran were killed as a result of some kind of decapitation strike, Iran's governmental structure would survive and would be more resilient against that kind of attack than it proved to be in the early days, in the first day of the 12-day war. So the Iranians are hunkering down. They're preparing for the attack. And for the record, the internet is still mostly shut across Iran, though, even though the protests in Iran have ended, with the Iranian authorities saying that around 3,000 people were killed during the protests altogether, of whom some 600 were what they claim were violent protesters, the people who tried to take over the protests, some of whom were armed and who conducted attacks. Anyway, the protests under control, but the internet still shut, and the Iranians apparently taking steps in advance of the attack, which looks like it may come. There are lots of reports about the movements of American aircraft and air defense systems to the Middle East, Patriot missile systems and THAAD systems, the very systems that, well, in the case of the Patriot, are now in critically short supply in Ukraine. The German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius all but admitted this. Anyway, one of the reasons they are in short supply is that the United States is trying, to the extent that it can, to beef up its defences in the Middle East and to beef up Israel's defences as well. Whether that is possible is another matter. Israel expended many air defence missiles during the 12-day war. It was running critically short of air defence missiles at that point. Obviously, there will have been attempts to make up the gaps since then, but we've seen that in the West, it is difficult to ramp up production of advanced air defence missiles. And it's debatable, or it seems to me debatable, whether the Israelis and the Americans can have made up for the losses that they suffered during the 12-day war, the June 12-day war, let alone make up the shortfalls that were already revealed by that war. But notwithstanding all of this, notwithstanding all of these warning lights, these amber lights that suggest that a war between Iran and the United States might be protracted, that it might result in an energy crisis if the Strait of Hormuz is closed, that Iran is taking steps to protect itself, it still seems to me that there is a powerful faction within the United States, which is the ear of the President of the United States, and which seems to be determined to push Iran hard, and they've been making demands of Iran, which, as I said, Iran would resist agreeing to, and that could end, that could ultimately bring us to the point of an actual American attack on Iran. Now, there are some suggestions that if that attack were to come, the United States would again do what it has done in the past. It would pull its punches. It would focus on attacking the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Basij militia headquarters. It would target those organizations. It would try to leave the Iranian military alone. It would try to avoid attacking the Iranian political leadership. It would try, in other words, to conduct a limited strike and hope that that didn't escalate into an all-out war. Well, I wonder whether that is possible. The risks of doing that seem to me extremely great. it always, that kind of game always relies anyway on the other side showing the same degree of restraint as you are. And given all that has happened, I wonder whether the Iranians would show the same level of restraint this time. And besides, if there is an attack on Iran and a limited attack of that kind, the risk the United States runs is that it would fairly quickly be seen to have been unsuccessful, or at least it would be represented in the West by those who do want an all-out war against Iran. It would be presented by them as unsuccessful. And then, in that case, demands for an escalation within the West itself might easily grow. So this is an incredibly dangerous game. I wonder whether the president fully understands what he is doing. I wonder whether the president understands very much of what he's doing anyway. He's got himself into a terrible position over the shooting of protesters in Minnesota. We've also had economic data from the United States. According to Bloomberg, consumer confidence in the United States crashed in January to the worst level that it has been in 12 years. In other words, since the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. A war against Iran at this time, which might cause the Gulf of Hormuz to be closed. Well, if that were to happen, it's impossible to see how oil prices would not surge. And I wonder whether the president is ready for that and for what could turn out to be a protracted war. Just saying. This again brings me back full circle to what the European Union is doing, because they're cutting themselves off from Russian gas at the time when the war drums in the Middle East are beating. Maybe they expect the government in Iran to fall and that this is the expectation. Maybe the calculation is that there will soon be abundant energy available because the government in Iran can fall, will fall, oil will be exported from Iran, gas will also be exported from Iran, and that the problems of the shortage of Russian gas will be rectified that way. There'll be a friendly government in Iran capable of providing and meeting all of Europe's needs. I remember that there was talk about that in the early 2000s, at a time when the European Union was trying to improve relations with Iran. And there was even more talk about that at the time of the protests in Iran in 2009, which were also expected by some people in Europe to lead to the collapse of the Iranian government. I think these are reckless calculations, if they are calculations, the calculations that are being made. I would have thought that there's a much higher likelihood of the Gulf of Hormuz being closed than there is of the Iranian government falling and of a new government stepping in, establishing tight control of the country and exporting gas and oil to Europe in that way. And even if the government were to fall, inevitably it would take some time, a year or two at the least, before the Iranian gas industry was in a position to supply gas to Europe. And that, by the way, is going to be a complicated story, and I'm not going to discuss it further in this program. Certainly, if there was a cut off of oil from the Gulf of Hormuz, the United States would be protected to some extent because it is self-sufficient in oil. Europe, of course, is not. Europe has now rejected Russian gas. Energy prices would surge. What are they going to do? And I would say that I think that there is a fair possibility that energy prices are going to rise anyway over the course of the next year or so, regardless of the situation in Europe and the general state of things between Europe and Russia. Briefly, there's been much discussion about the recent fall of the dollar and the rise in the price of gold. There's been much speculation that this is partly because that this is what's driving this are big oil purchases by the central banks of the BRICS countries, with China and India particularly identified as big gold buyers. I believe, by the way, that Russia, about a year ago, also started to buy gold again. The central bank there started to buy gold again, though, of course, they do it from their own domestic gold producers, just say. Anyway, whatever. I'm sure there is some of that going on, and I'm sure that is playing a part, a role, is part of the reason why gold prices are rising and the dollar is falling. And I have no doubt that there is indeed a long-term drift away from the dollar because of the overuse of the sanctions weapon, and more countries are indeed hedging against that. And the Reserve Bank of India, which India now chairs the BRICS for this year, is pushing for the BRICS states to develop systems to coordinate their new digital currencies with each other, which should be seen as a development of the plan that was first outlined in October 2024 in Kazan. So I've no doubt that politics, geopolitics, is playing a certain role in the surge in gold prices and the fall of the dollar. But my own view is that the single biggest, most proximate cause to the decline of the dollar and to the rise of gold is fiscal and monetary policies in the United States. The Trump administration is widening the US budget deficit, and it is pressuring the US Federal Reserve Board to cut interest rates. And as we know, there is a major conflict between the administration and the chair of the Federal Reserve Board, Jerome Powell. And Jerome Powell is now under federal investigation and could be facing a court case. And sooner or later, the Federal Reserve Board is going to cut interest rates further and faster than under Jerome Powell it must have done, it might have done. And this is all happening at a time when the Trump administration is increasing budgetary spending and is allowing the budget deficit to grow. And over and above and beyond all of that, the United States is now talking about spending an extra $600 billion in 2027 on the defense budget, which is inevitably going to make the domestic US federal budget deficit widen even further. Now, I can't see how that can have any result other than to increase the money supply in the United States significantly. And it looks to me like a further attempt to run the economy hot ahead of the November midterm elections. And of course, if you do this, if you run the economy hot, if you increase the money supply, then normally there would be an import surge because there's more money circulating and that money has to be converted into goods, or at least some of it does. But of course, the tariffs make that more difficult than might previously have been the case. And well, to me, all of this looks like at least threatening the possibility of higher domestic inflation in the United States. And if that does indeed happen, well, there will be significant political consequences of that for Donald Trump and his administration. But the usual outcome of higher inflation in the United States, of a fall in the dollar, is that individuals, companies, central banks, businesses, they want to try to hedge against the dollar, the fall of the dollar, to the extent that they can. They will buy gold and perhaps silver, but they will also start to buy oil, and or at least they will start to take out positions on oil. And the OPEC producers will then start to cut back on production and will begin to push up the price of oil, because they still get paid mainly in dollars, and they will want to make up for the dollar's fall by increasing the oil price. And we could very well see a significant increase in the oil price anyway before very long. Well, if that is the case, then the European Union's decision to stop importing Russian energy has come at just possibly the worst possible time. Just saying. And of course, if there is a big Russian offensive, well, things could start to look even worse with a deeper crisis in Europe, and nobody seems to be preparing for any of that. Well, this has been a rather discursive video today, touching on various topics. Remember, you can find all our videos on our various programs, Locals Rumble and X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. If you like this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.